history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that really ought to be told. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, boy, do we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And what a story we have in store for you today. You're going to hear about a device you've probably used thousands of times in your life that you don't know the origin of, and you're going to learn that today. You're going to hear from a man who really improved on it and spread it around the country. You're also going to learn about the Battle of Midway and how the intelligence came to being, how America found out what was happening on the Japanese side of things. And there are many, many other details. If you're a fly fisherman, maybe you'd like to hear some of the latest exploits of 104-year-old Jack Perrin, who joins us from Santa Barbara, California. That was not a misstatement. He really is 104 years old. So, Jack, I think we've got to start there, because I'm sure most people have never talked to someone who's 104. I usually save this for the end, but I'm going to go right up front. What's your secret? How have you made it to 104 years old and still be as sharp as you are today?
Well, I have a joke. I always tell everybody it's tequila. But it's not really.
I mean, there must be something that you have done or practiced or maintained to still be going so strong at that incredible age.
Well, I don't know. My mother was up in her middle 90s, and my real father was up there pretty much in the 90s, but he was divorced. I was raised by a stepfather.
And I was reading about that in your book, On a Roll, the story of entrepreneur Jack Perrin and Towel Saver Incorporated. Some people might recognize that Towel Saver name. Even if they don't, they've used a Towel Saver before. And I understand that this idea of a paper towel dispenser was actually born at a USC-UCLA football game when you went with Jay Perrin, your adoptive father?
That's absolutely correct. I was with him. That was the old days when the big Coliseum was a small. It wasn't as big as it is now. My dad would go to the games a lot. He'd take me. And he was in the restroom one time. I was with him. And you notice on the little square boxes where they have a folded towel, one fold, you pull one towel down that is divided in half. Sometimes now you pull one out, it comes like an accordion, but a lot of them are come by with just one fold. Well, they used to put a package on top of the dispenser, and like play special like the Coliseum. And, of course, they get spilled on the floor and it'd be a big mess. But nevertheless, that was a problem.
So he noticed that, and he thought, hey, maybe there's a better way to do this?
He thought there was a better way to do it. He picked them up, and he theoretically met. His dad was an inventor, too, actually. This is my stepdad now.
Right.
Wonderful guy. Wonderful man. A great father. Well, somebody, of course, naturally pulls it down. The whole thing goes on the floor. And so he saw that, and he got thinking about it. And so that's when he invented the thing that he invented, a paper towel dispenser. He had a lot of patents on it, and it was very good. He was very well thought of. And a very nice guy, Jay Perrin. When I was going to high school, I'd go down there working. We'd have these dispensers that we loaned out for no charge. And if they would buy our paper, I worked two jobs, really, because we didn't have much money in those days. We'd fix these dispensers. They'd have a crank on them, little square boxes. It was when they first came out. And you lift the lever and you turn a crank, and you get one towel. And the whole theory was that you'd have to do a little work to get a paper towel. And you wouldn't do in this old-fashioned way where you put a whole package on top and one falls on the floor. And that's what happened down at the Coliseum. And that was one thing that encouraged my father to develop the towel saver.
And you mentioned something there that I was struck by when reading your book here, On a Roll, where you said when he first developed this towel saver, he did one thing that was really crucial ultimately to the success of it. He didn't charge people for the dispensers. He let them use them for free.
Right.
But the paper had to be your paper because the dispenser wouldn't work with any other paper.
Absolutely.
Genius.
And that carried on for a long time. The government didn't like it. They said it was not fair or something like that. I don't know.
What high school did you go to?
I went to Fairfax High School.
And you were a pretty good athlete, I understand?
I wasn't real good, no, but I was satisfactory. I threw the shot with the discus, and the only one that beat me was Woodrow Strode, who was a very good athlete, but he developed some kind of a problem health-wise, and he couldn't do it anymore. So I took over as number two man on the UCLA team.
Yeah, so you're at UCLA in the late 30s. You finally graduated in 1941. When I saw that, immediately, I thought of some of the other people who were there at that time. Woody Strode is one of them. He went on to quite a career.
That's right.
In acting. People have seen him in Spartacus. I believe he also did some wrestling for a while and was a great football player on the UCLA team. And you played football there, too?
Oh, he was a good football player. Strode and Kenny Washington, and very nice people, nice men, and very well thought of. Kenny was a pretty good friend of mine. He's a very nice guy, Kenny was. And Strode, and they would pal around together, and I was in classes with some of them. I put the shot in discus.
Wasn't that the same time that guy Jackie Robinson was there?
That's exactly right. He'd come by and say, "Move away, I'm Jackie Robinson."
What did you enjoy the most about your time at UCLA? What was the highlight for you?
Well, I was in the fraternity. I still have my ring where I was president of my fraternity. We had two men that were children of, what's the guy's name, a movie actor with a big loud mouth.
Joey Brown?
Yeah, Joey Brown, senior, and his two sons were in our fraternity. And his dad, Big Mouth Joe, you know, he came and registered in one class for 1 year, one semester, so he could become a fraternity member, too.
The father did?
Yeah.
Huh.
He was a nice man, very nice guy. I enjoyed them all very much.
You know, one thing that I like to ask all the veterans I interview about, because it seems like everybody remembers something, whenever I throw out that date, December 7th, 1941, there always seems to be a memory. What do you remember about that day and how you found out about what happened at Pearl Harbor?
Yes, I do remember very well. When I was working for Aetna Life Insurance Company in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I graduated from UCLA. I got a job. My girlfriend picks up my diploma for me because I had to stay and work out of Pennsylvania. We arranged to get married, and then we decided not to. So we later on, when the war started and everything went differently, we snuck away and got married. We flew to Las Vegas to get married, and it was very funny because I didn't know how to salute or anything. And I got my commission in the Navy. I went down and bought my uniform and everything I was supposed to do. And in those days, if you went to college, you could become an officer right away. But it was my case. I didn't have to go to officer school or any of that stuff.
So you hadn't actually reported yet, but you had your uniform, and you got married in your uniform?
Yes, I did. I got off the plane. There was a guard there with a rifle with bayonets and everything, and he was saluting me. Hell, I didn't know how to salute, so I just said hi and didn't salute, which I feel embarrassed about ever since. But anyway, that's what was life in those days. We came back home and had 10 delightful days of a honeymoon, and I had saved up for a few $1,000s. And I said, saved it all. We spent it all in San Francisco, going to all the places and restaurants. And I would get up every morning, pack my suitcase, and go down to the Navy Department. They say to bring your clothes. You may not come back. So every morning for about 10 days, I'd take my suitcase, go down the Naval Building. It's a really big structure in San Francisco. And I'm waiting for a ship to take me away to Hawaii. Took my suitcase every day, every time I do it for about the 10 days, and then one time I didn't come back, and so she knew that. So now I'm gone for 2.5 years, kind of lonesome.
So they send you to Hawaii. I read that you were on basically a banana boat that the Navy put into service.
A banana boat, the USL Salamanca, and on the ship, they had me reading the code. Maybe we'd get messages from other people, and I was helped to decipher them and put them in the English. Because of that, I think they put me in the Naval Intelligence. They shipped me to Hawaii, and we started off, three actually, ended up doing it, going around checking on people and bad guys and good guys in Hawaii. At this point, we went to work at the Halekulani Hotel, which was owned by a big Navy officer, but that didn't last very long. At 10 days, shows and everything else in Hawaii. But after about a week, they called us in and said, well, you three guys are going down someplace else. Pack your bags and get in the station wagon. And we did and went down to the submarine base. And we were both, all three, went in to be inspected. And it was a secret passageway kind of in the basement. We went back down there, and it was a kind of a dungeon place with a special guard and all that. And it turned out to be a very secret place. It was where they were reading the Japanese code. So it was obviously a very secretive place. And we sneak down there. We go down the basic tunnel, another drop down, and you go in the basement of another building that was there. There was a senior officer in charge. He had a couple other officers around, but there wasn't too many people. And there were about a half a dozen men breaking codes.
Let me bring you right back there in a minute, but I do have another question, because you're arriving there in Hawaii about 6 months after the Japanese arrived in that surprise attack.
We were there in April.
So I'm guessing that you could still see evidence of what had happened in December. What were some of the things you saw, and was it jarring to you? Could you see the Oklahoma, the Arizona?
Oh, yeah, you could see all that. I didn't go out. I didn't go on a boat and look at them, but I could see the, something sticking up. And I knew, I was aware, of course, that they've been sunk with a lot of men. And then I had another one, but most of the men got off, and they were the band of one of the battleships, and the band got off.
I'm just curious, because here you are. If I do the math, you're 25 years old. This war has started, and now you're at the place where it began, and you're seeing something that I imagine might be a little sobering. When you see a battleship upside down or sunk and you know how many lives were lost, can you help us understand what kind of emotions maybe that produced in you?
I can't recognize that I had emotions. I think maybe I've been getting used to things that didn't bother me.
And you mentioned the band. So you're talking about the USS Maryland, which is another battleship that was damaged at Pearl Harbor, and Some of the bandsmen actually ended up working in that code room with you?
Absolutely. They worked with the translators. There were about five translators, about three of them working all the time, reading the Japanese code. There's a certain technique in reading codes and breaking them down, and they were very good at it. And they absorbed both of the music guys that had been on the battleship Maryland, and so most of the band went with our unit, but it was divorced from our unit, but it was part of our unit, you know what I mean.
And this was Hypo?
Yeah. Well, Roford was the commanding officer of the unit, and he was a Mustang, which means he did not go to the academy. The regular Navy people in Washington criticized him, but they wanted to have the glory of some of the success we had.
Well, and I want to talk about some of that success you had, but first maybe you can just help us understand, how far did you carry that secrecy? Were you allowed to tell any of your friends that this is what you were doing, or tell your wife that this is what you were doing?
Oh, God, no.
No.
Very, very secretive. This is breaking the Japanese code. We broke their code, and they didn't know we had done it. We could read the Japanese stuff, and they couldn't read ours, theoretically. I think they probably did read some of ours anyway.
I'm curious about the secrecy element. I'm sure you and your wife are writing letters back and forth. What did she think you were doing out there?
Well, every letter she got had things cut out. She didn't know anything about doing.
The censors took some scissors to it?
All my mail was censored, and it was cut out or erased or something. We understood about the work pretty well, because, I mean, it was so secret, and it was so important, because we were reading the code. Let's say it says a 15-20 ship convoy of Japanese coming from down south somewhere, and they're coming up to hugging the coast for safety, and they're coming right back up to Tokyo. We'd get some of those kind of things. So we could sit our submarines out, and maybe that'd be my watch. Let's say it's midnight, and I'm the only one on watch. If a message comes through, I'd have to send the message out to our submarine.
So when you say a message comes in, is that a message coming in plain English, or is that encoded?
Well, it could be encoded. Let's see, a message comes in Kan alphabet. And the Kan alphabet is, of course, the Japanese alphabet. Mm-hmm. But then we've broken the code so we can read it, some of them. We have four or five translators that are working on that. And these translators are people, including our commanding officer in my unit. They lived in Japan to learn the customs and to do it. I was very impressed by that. The fact that they had arranged ahead of time to watch out for it.
That there were people that had been living in Japan before the war who then could put that knowledge to use.
The Navy places men in key positions where they can learn things that will help them at the time of war. That's what came through to me. And it was very good. These were men like Mike Skipper, Rokeford. He was able to communicate in Japanese because he studied Japanese over there. So anyway, Rokeford was very, very capable man.
And we'll hear more about Joseph Rokeford and the secret work that he and Jack Perrin and others carried out at Station Hypo when we come back. The Battle of Midway was the pivotal moment of the Pacific War, but perhaps the most important break in that battle came in that basement dungeon, as Jack called it, at Pearl Harbor. We'll learn more about it from this 104-year-old Navy veteran when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.